Captain Wright, Reel 7. What were your orders when you left the Alamein battlefield area?
Well, we were told we were to join Pi Force primarily because our brigade had been detached from 5th Indian Division to 4th Indian Division for the duration of the Alamein battle, well, for the ones before it too, Al-Halfa. So what we were actually doing was rejoining 5th Indian Division to make it up to 3 brigades. We were told, I don't think we were actually told what our role was, but it seemed to be training, which was always what we had to do when we were not fighting. I discovered later that one of the reasons was deception of enemy intelligence into thinking or being led to think that there were more Allied troops south of the Caucasus than there actually were. And that was borne out by the fact that quite close to us, in the same camp, in fact, I think, south of Baghdad, we had a very cloak and dagger looking outfit called Phantom Force, I think. We were intrigued because, although we never met him, one of the members of Phantom Force at that time was David Niven, who we all thought was rather marvellous, but anyway, we never saw him. But it does bear out the fact that there was some subterfuge, intelligence-wise, of which we were part.
When you were in the Western Desert, did you ever hear of a body called R Force?
I can't say that we did, no. Of course, you must remember I was only a second lieutenant then, and I was not party to some of the things that went on at, say, brigade level. So, no, I never knew R Force at all.
How did you actually get to Pi Force? What was the journey like?
Well, we had our own transport, which was fundamentally a rather good machine called, I think it was a Dodge. It was a 30 hundredweight, and 30 hundredweight, yes, I think it was, maybe a 3-tonner, four-wheel drive, American, and it was wonderful. It was left-hand drive. But to augment that, in order to carry all the kit we had an RASC transport unit with 3-tonners. And we were to travel across, across the canal, through the Sinai Desert, through what was in Palestine, through Jordan, and across the onto the Damascus-Baghdad road. I think it took us 5 days.
Was this done as a tactical move or as an administrative move?
Well, I think neither. I think it was a strategic move, really. But it, at the same time, as I was saying, it was a kind of rectifying what had been the presence of a division of only 2/3 strength. And so we were making up 5th Indian Division, which were already there for what I presume was a strategic purpose. And we were just occupied in training, really. I may say that I took very little part in this because within about 5 days of getting there, I was taken for a ride by, literally, by our new second-in-command, who had joined as a subaltern to replace somebody who was captured. A chap called Bettison, I think, was the fellow who was captured. I won't say who the second-in-command was, but he was not a particularly agreeable fellow. And we went off in a Canadian Chev, I think it was, one of these blunt-nosed things. And this chap was a great poseur, and he always liked to appear sort of frightfully tough and all the rest of it. And he affected, amongst other things, a pair of driving gloves, you see. And we were batting along this bun road. It was about 20 feet, not as much, maybe 15 feet, raised from the general level of the ground around it. And as we were passing Baghdad Airport, I was a passenger, and I'd never flown until then. I was watching these aircraft taking off and wondering what it would be like, only to find that we ourselves had taken off. This fellow, second in command, had allowed the wheel to slip through his hands, and we were airborne. And we went straight over the edge. I can remember seeing the tops of the trees below the airborne truck, and we crashed in down below, and I was not semi-conscious. He, for his part, was unhurt and wandered off. I was left as a victim of marauding Iraqis, a thing that never endeared me to them as a race, and apparently stripped of practically all my clothing, my wallet, my documents, and all the rest of it. And then I was carted off to hospital by some well-wisher, where I spent 2 months recovering from this. But the only high spot of the my sojourn in hospital was the fact that this second command never had the grace or the conscience or anything to come and visit me, something for which I was very glad. He was a very unpleasant fellow. So I rejoined them, I suppose, in about April. And then in May, we had to set off down to Basra to get on a troop ship, which was to take us via India to Burma.
You said that you didn't particularly care for the Iraqis. Did you have any other close contact with them other than this experience of being pillaged?
Oh, well, quite a few, yes. We were moved south of Baghdad towards Euphrates, and the desert, which is mainly what it was there, was crisscrossed with old aqueducts, not an aqueduct, well, raised canals, and for irrigation purposes. But they were, centuries old and were in a state of disrepair, and they just appeared here and there, and in between they'd been excavated, I suppose. But one of these cut through our camp, and we had an experience which showed really what they were given to these people. They came into various units around us, into the camps, and pinched weapons. Well, we were determined not to let them do that to us. We wired the whole place in, and where this wire crossed one of these aqueducts, we, which was a good line of approach for any subterfuge, we laid a booby trap, and we put a tripwire within this barbed wire, and this led to an igniter about 2 feet back towards the outside of the perimeter. Anyway, at about 11 o'clock one night in the mess, which was a tent, we heard a loud bang outside, and it followed, as always, by indisciplined random firing of small arms. When we'd quelled this, we went out. We found that some poor unfortunate bloke had come in, hit the wire with his head, and this gun cotton slab had blown him in half, really. But I think But the worst thing was that the local sheikh, who patently had persuaded this chap to go in there and pinch what he could, came to congratulate us. I mean, we found them quite despicable. But then, of course, I suppose if one is detached from them in the way that we were, one doesn't get to know them. I'm sure there were some very nice ones, but my particular experience didn't endear me to them.
Do you know what sort of training was going on in the camp when you were away in hospital? What sort of things were they doing? Was it continuation training, or were they learning new things?
Oh, it was continuation training, really. One of the tales that came to me was of wet bridging, which involved pontoons, and we did it on a lake at Habonier, which was about 20 or 30 miles west of Baghdad, and it contained an RAF station. And apparently this exercise, we put this bridge in and some troops ran across it or something or other, but it involved a kind of scheme, I think is the word for it. And there were the infantry taking part and the sappers and all the rest of it. And I think, no, what it was, they'd dropped airborne troops out of a Vickers Valencia, which was a great big, clumsy, great biplane, a transport. And apparently this chap, the pilot, who dropped these parachutists, decided that he was going to have a bit of the action. So he sort of buzzed the assembled throng, very senior officers, all standing by their vehicles on this bund. And he misjudged it a bit. He came too low. And he hit my Jeep, I being in hospital at the time. And to the day that I said goodbye to that Jeep, when it fell to pieces, I think about a year at least later, it bore the treadmarks of the undercarriage, fixed undercarriage of this this aircraft. It took away with it, I think we retrieved it, the complete hood of the Jeep, trail like a sort of banner behind it. But I don't know what happened to the pilot, he's probably grounded. For the rest, I suppose, we did, I can't think what else we did. We must have done infantry training as well, probably, but as I say, I wasn't with them for more than about a month.
When you did the move from Egypt to south of Baghdad, was that without any pauses? Did you keep driving all day, every day, or did you have stops?
We stopped a night. Mm-hmm. We stopped at a place called Ramallah, which was in Palestine. We stopped at a place, I forget what it was called, in Jordan. We stopped at a place with a name like K2 or something. Yes, I suppose there were about four or five stops.
When you were doing this movement, were you on road all the way, or were you going across open country as well?
On the road all the way. And one of the hazards of this road, which was single carriageway, was that the traffic on it was not very heavy, but it included one of these express buses run by some Australian firm, I think, called Nairn Transport, I think they were called. And they were a big articulated thing, air-conditioned and, oh, frightfully luxurious. And this thing just belted down this road, and anything that got in its way, because it was very heavy, just had to get off and into the sand on either side. And in convoy, you wouldn't be able to see what was coming towards you. Looking at the back of the truck, about sort of 50 feet away from you, suddenly this would disappear, and in its place coming towards with this walking great bus.
What sort of speed could you keep up normally, day to day, going along?
Well, I think we used to, the speed was 27 miles in the hour. Now, whether that included the obligatory 5 minutes in the hour physical stop, for anybody that wanted to have a pee or anything, I don't know, but it was fairly leisurely.
What did you do for your overnight stops? Did you go into a lager, or were you just stopped on the road, or beside the road, in column?
Oh, I can't remember what happened. I can't imagine we put up tents and took them down again, but I suppose we must have done. Yes, we weren't... There were no sort of camps that we could make use of. To be honest, I can't remember. I think we must have just put tents up and taken them down again, yes.
Now, you're in hospital most of the time, but did you notice any, at your level, did you notice any change of style or atmosphere once you joined the 5th Division, having been serving with 4th Division?
Not particularly, no. I can't say that there was. We were very spread out, and I suppose being brigaded, we didn't get much further than brigade headquarters in knowing what was happening. No. No, I don't think I noticed any change.
What happened then when you started moving? Did you know where you were going when you moved from your camp near Baghdad?
Yes, I forget why we had to move down. I think it was... what was the reason for it? I think we possibly did some training that involved the Euphrates River. I'm trying to remember. No, maybe they just... I think... Our accommodation near Baghdad was a good deal more, I can't say luxurious, but they had static things like what they called drip and flash stoves, which was crude oil in a 44-gallon drum with a sort of tap on it, which dripped onto a piece of angle iron, and it produced a flame, and the flame... Oh, it had water with it as well. You put a drop of water on, and anyway, you got this jet of flame which went into an empty, horizontally placed 44-gallon drum, and it heated the place. Because this was January, the early months of the year, and it was quite cold. But when we went further south, we may have made them, but I can't remember now. We were less static than we were around Baghdad. That may have been the reason for our moving.
Did you get any sense of the political atmosphere inside Iraq at that time?
No, we... had a visit from the king of Iraq, Hussein, who was a little chap of about 12, I think. Poor chap, he was murdered by the some coup later on. Not while we were there, but we got the general impression that... they weren't averse to our presence there.
What happened then at the end of the time in Iraq? Where did you go next?
Went down to Basra and got on this ship called the Nawasa, troop ship. And it took us about a couple of days, I suppose, to get to Bombay. We just sort of sat on board and ate and drank and read, and that's about all, I think.
Did you know what you were going to do when you got back to India?
Yes, we weren't expressly told, but I mean, the general gossip was that we were going to go into Burma, which didn't impress us greatly.
Why not?
Well, we'd heard about how the Japanese had behaved in Malaya, and they sounded pretty unpleasant, really. In fact, I seem to remember at some stage, fairly early on, they distributed to us copies of photographs of the various Japanese atrocities. And it created a totally different approach to warfare. I had no compassion at all for the Japanese. Actually, I mean, we treated them well enough. At Kohima later on, we captured two. They were very bad. Well, one was mortally wounded. The other committed suicide. But we didn't treat them as they would have done us. We put the wounded chap in the regimental aid post, and he quietly died. But again, looking forward, this was borne out by the fact that when they put their first counterattack in the Arakan, they should be preoccupied with any kind of soft target. And they came round behind into the largely administrative area, and they went into a hospital there with a lot of wounded or sick people in bed, and the first thing they do is bayonet them all. Now, if I'd been more senior than I was, I think I'd have arranged a sort of dummy hospital, and then if they came into our perimeter, they'd go straight for it to do this usual atrocity, and they'd all be sitting ducks. But it seemed to me, we were told what wonderful troops they were, but I can't think that their preoccupation with bayoneting defenseless people can have served any useful purpose, except a negative one. I mean, we had a fellow captured, one of the West Kents, in conditions which prevailed there. We didn't have any defensive wire at all. And when you had been attacked all night and firing at, so everything was very close and hand to hand, at first light you looked around to see if one of your mates was in the nearest weapon pit or whether it was a bloody Jap. And this chap, I suppose, looked out and he found himself isolated, and so they captured him. They tied him up to a tree and used him as, I think it was not bayonet practice, I think they were just sort of shooting at him. That didn't impress me at all. But, no, I think it was quite a good thing. It made me very careful, because one feared capture or being wounded much more than being killed, which was quite a good thing. I mean, the patrols we were on, they were the most frightening part of things, I think. We were wandering around, always in full moonlight, probing to see where they were. We were absolute sitting ducks. But good luck prevailed, and there we were.
When these photographs were produced, were they shown to the sappers as well as the officers?
Oh, yes, everybody, yes.
What reaction was there from the soldiers in your field company?
Well, sort of ejaculations of mild horror, and they were all very, what's the word, not complacent at all, but level-headed. They didn't start screaming, shouting, and jumping about, no. But I think, well, I know that British troops are much more sympathetic towards their enemy than almost any other lot I've known. The only example of ill treatment I saw was when we were building a bridge in the Arakan, and we pushed the enemy off the nearest feature, so we weren't under direct fire, but we kept getting hit by artillery fire. And one of my NCOs found a local villager up on this hill which the Japanese had occupied with a mirror, and he dragged him down. And when I came upon the scene, he and another bloke, I think we were both pummeling this chap, you see, and I rushed up. He was civilian. And I said, hey, stop that, what are you doing? And they said, oh, well, he's signalling to the Japanese, that's why we were being shelled. So I thought, well, that's no answer to anything. So we stuck him in my jeep, take him off to the, what were they called now? Well, I suppose they were military policemen. They were part of the sort of security force, I suppose. And I thought, well, none of my business. They can interrogate him and find out what they want. And we stuck him in the back of my jeep, and the NCO was in the back, and there was somebody else next to me. And off we went, and as we drove along, suddenly there's commotion behind, and this NCO was pummeling this bloke, you see. And I said, I told you to bloody well stop, what are you doing? And he said, look, sir, the chap was so frightened he peed in the back of the jeep. And so, I mean, the message is really, was to me, that these fellows had been promised our protection. We hadn't given it to them. The Japanese had come in. I don't know that I'd have done exactly the same, but I think a lot of people fail to see, as regards civilians, what a predicament they're in. But I never saw anything as regards British troops being unpleasant to enemy at all.
Do you think that the atrocities changed the attitude to enemy of the Indian soldiers? Because you'd seen them in action in the Western Desert, where they're up against the Germans and Italians. Did they have a different view of the Japanese?
Very hard to say. Very hard to say, because in the desert it was all rather remote. I don't think, to be honest, I ever came under small arms fire in the desert. It was always artillery or anti-tank or something like that. Whereas in Burma, it was all very close. And so, I suppose, I saw many more Japanese soldiers than I'd ever seen Germans. I remember, sorry to mess around, but our attitude, or my attitude, to the enemy in the desert was quite different. I can remember we constructed an observation post.